So we will now go on to discuss paper 2C. Paper 2C deals with the impairment for reinsurance assets. And more specifically, we are going to ask the board how to treat the likelihood that a reinsurer would actually default, so the expected credit losses of reinsurance assets. I think before we start, and the beginning of the paper sets it out, it is important to look at just reinsurance contracts again and be reminded of a few things. And first of all, the scope of the proposed standard does include how the policyholder of a reinsurance contract would account for the transaction. Secondly, reinsurance is essentially insurance for insurers. And one of the key things and the reasons why insurers take it out is essentially to transfer the risk of the underlying insurance contracts to the reinsurer. Two key principles in accounting for the reinsurance is, first of all, we will also base it on the present value of the risk-adjusted expected cash flows. So that full mouthful of insurance accounting. And secondly, reinsurance contracts are kept separate from the underlying insurance contracts. To date, the board has made two important decisions in this project, and it firstly confirmed that a cedent would take into account expected credit losses as part of the fulfillment cash flows in determining a reinsurance contract or the reinsurance asset in this case. And secondly, the ISB made a decision last year to apply IFRS 9 impairment accounting in assessing the recoverability of those reinsurance assets. Now, the reason why we are bringing this paper to the board is really, in essence, we had started looking at all the accounting for reinsurance contracts, and we realized with the decisions the board has taken to date and subsequently the developments in both the insurance project as well as the impairment project caused a conflict of how we are going to treat the non-performance risk, but specifically associated with the credit losses. So if we think about insurance accounting, one of the big developments that we had was in the residual margin. And the board had decided that the residual margin would be unlocked for all favorable or unfavorable changes in expected cash flows. The board motivated that decision by first thinking that the residual margin does represent the unearned profit of the contract. And accordingly, as expectations changes about those cash flows, including expected credit losses, it will need to correct and adjust that residual margin to reflect the new expected unearned profit. For reinsurance contracts, it was worded a bit differently, but it might also represent the cost of taking out that reinsurance. Secondly, it avoids some counterintuitive results. For example, it avoids certain contracts appearing loss-making in 1 year, but overall those contracts are still profitable. And lastly, it treats the day one estimates as well as the day two estimates in a similar manner. Consistent with those arguments also, the board then decided that both a day one gain or loss in the instance of a reinsurance contract would be deferred and recognized over time. This caused for reinsurance for the cedent, we can either defer a day one gain or a day one loss, which will then be recognized as a residual margin. In considering how to account for the risk of non-performance, and specifically on expected credit losses, we presented in the paper two alternatives. Alternative one relates to the one decision the board has made, and that's essentially the unlocking decisions. So alternative one is presenting if we follow the insurance contract proposals and ignores the impairment proposals. So the ISB decided that all favorable and unfavorable changes, including expected credit losses, would unlock the residual margin. This will cause that at inception, we would include the lifetime expected losses in calibrating to the residual margin, and subsequently, all changes in those expected losses would unlock the residual margin. So nothing will get recognized in profit and loss in that period that there's a change in expectation. Alternative 2 said, we consider the board decision on applying IFRS 9 to consider the recoverability of the asset. And essentially, the alternative is going to overlay the requirements of payment on top of the insurance contracts. This will cause that we will first, on day one at inception, include in our determination of the residual margin our expected losses, and on top of that, recognize the 12-month expected credit loss as developed in the impairment project on top of that, which will cause an effect in profit and loss. Subsequently, we will reassess the 12-month expected credit loss, which also might trigger a lifetime expected loss if the criteria is met, and those differences are all recognized in profit and loss immediately. In the paper, we looked at the two alternatives and we presented two examples. Example 1 made an apparent gain, and example 2 made an apparent loss. The staff would like to ask the board the following question. Does the ISB agree that a cedent should account for the risk of non-performance associated with expected credit losses in the same way as other changes in expected cash flows, i.e. we would not apply the impairment of financial asset criteria to the credit expected credit losses? In clarifying this question, we would really like to ask the board two things. First of all, on day one, does the board agree to apply the principles of insurance accounting and that we would include the expected credit losses in calibrating the residual margin? And secondly, does the board agree that subsequently we would update for the expected credit losses and unlock the residual margin for those changes? And I open the discussion.
Yes.
Question to the staff. On paragraph 20 and 21, when you explore the effect of credit losses. So you mentioned in 21 that as a consequence, the second paragraph, the second sentence. In the period that a change in expected loss occurred, the carrying amount of the reinsurance asset will not change. Can someone
explain?
Think that this means the asset is overstated? And do you believe users have a particular interest in this piece of information?
I think to address your first question, I think some people might feel uncomfortable by the fact that the reinsurance asset value does not change, yet there was a credit, expected credit loss that increased during the period. But I think it is important to remember what a reinsurance assets consist of, and there are really two elements. The first is that it is the cash flows that we expect to fulfill, and that would have decreased. And secondly, is the residual margin that is being deferred. Now, it can either be a gain or it can be a loss in the case of reinsurance. If it is a gain, we are going to decrease that gain. So in subsequent periods, a lower amount is going to be released to profit and loss. And if it is a loss, that loss will increase. And subsequently, that loss will be recognized. A bigger loss will be recognized over the period of cover. Yes, the value might not change, but I do think the information contained within that asset still has to be assessed, and that will change. Now, there are disclosures already in the current drafting that we have that does cover your maximum exposure to credit risk, as well as disclosing the credit quality of those reinsurers' assets. So, my view, and I wrote the paper for that, but I'm comfortable with the fact that the asset doesn't change because I do feel the relevant information is reflected on that.
And will be reflected in the disclosure as we have today in our proposal.
It will be reflected in the disclosures, not in the profit and loss necessarily.
I would suggest for this point, if we do agree with this alternative, to be clearly stated as in the base for conclusion.
Philippe? In the unlikely situation where you have a loss at inception, and because of the increase in the credit loss expectation, the loss will just increase over time, does it really make sense to defer the recognition of that extra loss over time? Because in fact, you have a kind of onerous contract, which becomes even more onerous. And in general, we don't spread the recognition of the more onerous contracts over time. So that would be an exception to some basic principles. We have to justify that.
I just think with that approach, and it really comes back to the decision the board made of why it deferred the day one loss. And the board's motivated as part of that decision that it does not represent an onerous contract, that it considered it as part of the cost that we pay for the reinsurance. So consistent with that decision, it will just mean that it will cost you even more for the reinsurance to continue.
It represents the expense of having reinsurance coverage over time, and you recognize that expense over the time you expect to get the coverage.
That is true. A reinsurance policy has a price, has a cost, and that's an expense. Now, if you have an increase in the credit loss, that means your coverage, you won't get it. In fact, I'm not sure it is the same type of cost as the cost of obtaining insurance. In
Carol?
At the risk of piling on, Phil, the two questions that effectively you asked, I think the first one, I would strongly see us wanting to apply the insurance model here, because I think this is an insurance asset. It's got some very key distinguishing features, current cash flows, current discount rates, current measurement of risk, which you wouldn't see in the normal circumstances where we apply our payment model. So parking that for the moment. I would, though, very strongly agree with what I think Amaro and Felipe said, that once we're in the insurance space, the second part of your question is, what do we do with the changes in credit risk over time? And it just feels to me like that is something completely different to what you envisaged when you entered into the contract. The logic behind saying that we can accept an expense, that we can park that loss, if you like, over a period of time for the reinsurance asset is about the fact that you're getting a service that on day one you're getting at market value on that day one. And so you're accepting the fact that you might be paying a little bit more than you expect to get back, but it's because you're getting other compensatory things in that service. Once credit starts to kick in, that feels like something you wouldn't have taken into account. It feels like something completely different. And to my mind, it becomes then the same sort of situation as if you have a service with a service provider and you no longer believe the service provider can provide the service, but you have to keep paying. That starts to feel like a different circumstance, a different scenario. So I would be inclined to go down something that says insurance model, but with some kind of way of recognizing the deterioration in credit as and when it happens in profit and loss.
Really, the second, almost subsequent flow of those changes affect profit and loss, and then
day one, there's no loss because you've acknowledged the expected cash flows, you're paying for those expected cash flows. But day two, when something changes, I would acknowledge that loss in profit and loss.
Patricia?
Other than the obvious fact that applying the impairment model results in double counting on day one, which happens with that model no matter what it's applied to, can you elaborate a little bit more on why the impairment model shouldn't be applied to an insurance contract asset?
I think different spaces. For me, it is really a case of seeing this credit risk as part of just that's expected cash flows. So it is treating it consistent with all other expected cash flows in this contract. That's one of the main things. It is seeing as part of the service that we fulfill for that contract. It doesn't distinguish at all. We say non-performance risk is taken into account. Non-performance risk can either arise from disputes. So the reinsurer and the insurer is actually arguing about whether they're going to get that, or it will arise with credit risk per se. And it's really saying, well, non-performance risk should be treated consistent. And apart from that also, the insurance model as it is currently standing, and it's touching a bit on what Daryl was explaining, is it is a current value measurement. So it is updated current estimates of expected fulfillment that you're taking into account.
The result is already built into the model, basically.
And the result of changes. Differences.
That's true of loans, too.
Exactly.
Changes in expected losses are also built into the model.
Amortized costs, so you're not picking that up.
Yeah.
So you need a mechanism, a different mechanism, to pick it up because of the amortized costs.
So if you applied the impairment model, then what you're essentially saying is that the changes in the cash flows in building block one,
yes,
that are related to credit would not be picked up because we only make a subsequent adjustment to the impairment allowance if there's a significant deterioration, but under the insurance model, you're picking up any deterioration at all.
Okay. So I think to clarify there and getting to your understanding, so if we have the insurance and then we overlay the impairment, so on day one, initially, we will include all our expected cash flows, including credit on that day, then create the 12-month expected.
And that's just
that
like,
got to the double
like
counting
concern
you raised. Subsequent to that then, we won't change our estimates in building block one. From that point on, we have to imply the impairment model. So we will have 12-month expected credit losses, and that will update.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a significant deterioration in credit, that will trigger then, in terms of the impairment model, the lifetime expected losses. Now, it sounds by what you're explaining, the one concern that you have, if we look at alternative one versus alternative two is doing it, alternative one will always update the credit in building block one lifetime expectation because there is no threshold to go over. So the difference between that we recognize versus an alternative two will get lost up to the point where significant credit deterioration is triggered.
Right.
So if that clarifies then.
Yeah, for me, that's the negative of alternative two. The positive of alternative two is the loss is going through P&L currently. So it's sort of a trade-off.
I don't know if there's anything.
But I think under alternative one, there is a second choice to be made. You could choose on day two to put the losses, credit losses, changes to profit and loss. So we'd like to take the questions almost in two steps, as Hugh teed up. On day one, do you agree to apply the insurance model? And on day two, do you want these to unlock the residual margin, or do you want to go through profit and loss? That's a secondary question. I don't think alternative one rules that out.
Daryl, that was your point,
wasn't
it?
Yes.
Okay.
And what was Daryl's answer to that point?
You go through profit and loss.
You would prefer profit and loss.
Yeah. No 12-month loss on exception, profit and loss afterwards.
Okay, Stephen?
So I agree with Daryl, and I don't think we should apply one as written for the reasons others have said. You need that loss in the income statement. I don't think we should apply two for the reasons you've been articulating. So I would do what Daryl is saying, but there are different ways you can do it. You could do it within the insurance model, but just then split up the change in the cash flows between the change in the contractual cash flows and then the change in the contractual cash flows adjusted for credit, and then that bit flows through the income statement. Alternatively, you could do it within an impairment model, because if you were to apply the purchase credit impaired methodology, you would get to the same answer. And that's the way I would do it, simply from a bookkeeping perspective, but I think you can do it either way.
Okay. Rego?
I'm not sure, you know, Daryl, Steve, from beginning, why you support unlock? Now, I think from two sides, I really find difficult to understand. You will stand differently. You know, look at the liability side. If there is a changes of a claim pattern and that kind of cash flow based on the decision will flow into the residual margin, we call it unlock. And some kind of, you know, expected outflow increase. And we agree, or I'm not sure whether, you know, all of us agree, but on the asset side, you know, I feel hard to understand. We change our position, you know, for the expected loss because of the credit, and we want to, you know, recognize it immediately in profit loss. Of course, I can understand from one point of view,
Steve always like full catch-up for impairment. But now we are talking about insurance contracts. And so I feel, you know, logically, how can you justify why you both sides have different position? So I will fully support the staff proposals and, you know, recognize the possible credit loss of part of the cash flow. And since we decide unlock, and we follow the same logic.
Okay, can I answer that?
Sure.
Imagine you have a reinsurance asset and there's little credit risk. So you're booking it in the way we suggest, and you've got a margin, you've got the expected cash flows. And then the credit risk of that reinsurer gets worse and worse and worse. So the expected cash flows get smaller and smaller because of that credit risk. Effectively, what you're doing, although there's no net effect, is crediting that expected cash flow, that receivable, and then you're debiting the residual margin. And that residual margin just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But when do you stop? What happens if the reinsurer goes bust? Now you've got zero expected cash flows, and everything is in the residual margin. And that doesn't make sense because you're no longer getting any service. So at some point, you've got to debit the income statement. And it becomes then entirely artificial at what point you do that.
I think this another issue, you know, how should we treat, you know, residual margin? And at what point, just like whether we want to have a cap or others. So on the liability side, we decide you can unlock margins, but at what point you will use out all the residual margin, that's all. Now we can discuss, but I feel hard to understand.
I think what Steve is explaining is because we've got an asset in the reinsurance context and we didn't carry over the notion for the normal insurance counting that the residual margin can't be negative because we wanted to spread the gains and the losses when you buy an insurance contract. We don't have an equivalent limit beyond which you start recognizing things in profit and loss. So you could do it by imposing a limit.
Yes, yeah,
or
this
you're
is
recognizing
what I say.
Profit or loss. So there's a different way you can go about that as well, isn't there?
Okay. The model that started by Daryl and subsequently supported by others has an appeal to me for many reasons. Reason one is that it kind of achieves what our initial exposure draft on the impairment tried to do it. You expect your original loss. You amortize that over a period of time. Any true up to that goes through the income statement. The big difference here is that you're only putting 12 months into the first bucket when you expect it, right? That's the only difference I see it, but I see a lot of appeal to that because when you put the residual margin, you are doing both the ins and outs. The ins and outs includes credit loss. So I can see the logic for hanging the initial day one loss estimate on the as a part of the residual margin, but any update is a change in that estimate, and we do it for the discount rate. Similar to that, we need to do this for this, and I think it makes a lot of sense to do two step, put it on the day one, and any true ups goes through the income statement. The other aspect is that unrelated to this area, in certain jurisdictions, they do the foreign currency losses onto the hanging it on the balance sheet and amortizing it. Most people found that they would never get a chance to completely write it off. I see the same exact problem coming up when you start accumulating losses and you don't know what the triggering point is to bring it down. So I think all in all, it's a mixture of the two models, and I think that has a lot of appeal to it. I don't want to completely go away from the impairment model because I think this is an asset. We did it for receivables, we did it for the lease receivables, we did it for all receivables.
But we did it for no other current receivables, current valued receivables.
Generally receivables, especially accounts receivable for 12 months.
No, sorry, by current I mean fair value.
Yeah.
This is effectively a fair value.
Fair value OCI.
Nothing we measure.
For OCI, yes, we did for OCI.
Yeah.
doesn't matter.
Martin?
Yeah, I also agree with Dara's proposal, but I'm a little bit struggling why we're doing that then only for this impairment stuff, but not for others, because I understand for the normal insurance contract, we unlock the residual margin, but we have, as discussed already, we have a point where we stop, and that is where the residual margin gets negative, but here not. And then if we follow Daryl's proposal, we do it for impairment, but what is for other things? Why we don't do it for other things? So we can have what Stephen describes, and the residual margin gets higher and higher and higher. And then my question is, and I was not part of this decision, but why do we really want to unlock this residual margin for a reinsurance asset? Because that is really deferring losses. Because I understand that we, at day one, we spread because we buy insurance coverage, and then, okay, that we then, this kind of service, we, the cost for that we spread over the term of the contract. But if things get worse, then the question is, okay, why we want to unlock that? It gets negative, negative, and negative. And how is that consistent then with if you look at an insurance contract where we stop when it goes negative? Because then we say, no, we don't want to defer losses. But here we're doing that.
I think it comes down to earlier conversations that we had on what the board considered the loss to be for a reinsurance versus what it considers for the underlying insurance contract. Now, I agree in terms of the point that you're raising, where the concern is that you're having is that what the arguments are is that people don't consider the credit risk to then be associated with the services and how it gets rendered, which is the arguments that we also put forward for why certain people maybe have wanted alternative two, except that it does appear that people also agree that they don't want to go the full extent of alternative two. And it almost in your case, what you are saying is you're also fine with the day one loss, if I'm understanding you correctly. You're fine with the day one loss, but it is those subsequent increases associated with credit losses that also your concern comes in. And I think it touches on a point, I think it was Daryl that raised it.
He says everything goes to income statement.
Is it the day one loss?
Changes for the
everything changes.
Subsequent changes, and if that increases,
all
really,
subsequent changes, or only because of credit?
No, we have decreases of an asset. It's like impairment, and my concern is, we have it for impairment. I think I said I'm with the proposal what Daryl said. Okay, immediately in P&L. But then my question is, why we do it then for only for credit concerns, but if for other reasons when the expected cash flows differ, which would decrease the insurance assets, the reinsurance assets, you defer losses into the future. And then is a question, what is the rationale to do it for credit and not for others?
And I hope I'm correct in saying this, but there's an element of, and it's a misused word in insurance, but there's an element of mirroring that's happening here, because on the insurance liability side, we are unlocking for cash flows, we are not unlocking for risk, and we're not unlocking for discount. On the reinsurance asset side, we're treating the asset exactly the same way. So we're unlocking the asset for precisely the same things as we're unlocking the liability, and we're not unlocking the asset for the same things.
It's not right, Derek, because we stop when the margin is negative. Margin is negative, and that is here.
I'll get to that in a second. So the difference is credit risk, and the reason why credit risk can be treated different is that it is unique to the reinsurance asset. You don't have that corresponding situation on the liability. So there is an argument for saying that you can treat credit risk differently because of its
regions. I think there's a couple of issues flying around in the room.
Let Daryl finish.
Okay. I was just going to say then, in terms of the stop point for me, the fact that you've got the stop point on the asset, on the liability and not on the asset, is that essential service nature of the reinsurance. I would think that in most reinsurance contracts, you don't expect it to be cash flow positive, because you're paying more, not just for the cash flows you expect to receive, but also for the risk coverage that you're getting. You're getting an element of risk coverage that comes into it. And that makes it far more difficult to assess that situation, I think, in terms of the residual margin.
But my understanding was, man, if you look at an insurance contract, then, okay, you accept it, okay, that you unlock the residual margin, and then, okay, I defer any changes, okay, then to the future. But you stopped when residual margin becomes negative. So you were not willing to defer losses. Is that right? I think that is the reason. But that is the same here, because we are on the asset side. And if an asset decreases, we're deferring losses. When my question is why we are not happy if we're looking at an insurance contract, but we are fine if we're looking at an insurance reinsurance asset, then it is okay. But if you look at an insurance contract, it's not okay. That was my question. Why is that different?
And if I could try and answer that, I think it's because we see that it's not a loss as such, it's not a prepayment in the sense of an expense that you're going to incur as you receive the coverage from the reinsurance contract over time. So it's not that you've written a financial instrument in a loss position, it's you're deliberately paying for something that you know you're going to get over time, so the appropriate time to recognise that expense seems to be in accordance with the service you expect to get under the contract. I think in the discussion there's two issues really coming up, and I'm going to suggest we defer one. One is whether you think you've bought this reinsurance contract and you're willing to pay a certain amount for the coverage you've got. When that cost of that becomes more, do you want to recognise that as a immediate in P&L expense, or do you want to just say that you've got an expense and you're spending more of an expense? And I think this is the limit that we've been talking about. The other concern I'm hearing is, why is it that we're unlocking for some cash flows and not other cash flows? And I think this is something we've already touched on this morning, and I don't know if you wanted to comment, John, on how consistent that is with what we've discussed this morning.
I saw a difference between changes in the contractual cash flows and changes in non-performance risk of the cash flows. And I tried to put it in paragraphs 45 and 46 of the paper. And the reason for... basically, the insurer, the direct insurer is paying for a service from the reinsurer. And there may be a change in the estimates of the cash flows, but even if there is a change in the estimate of the cash flows, the contractual cash flows, the direct insurer, I think, is getting the same service. He's getting the same coverage against insured events. And all that's changing is the reinsurer's costs of providing that service and hence the reinsurer's profits as well. So I could see that as the costs change, you do just alter the residual. But what's happening when there's a deterioration in credit is that the actual service that the reinsurer is receiving is declining. And for that reason, it's not that the reinsurer's business is becoming more profitable, it's actually that the service is declining. So I saw a difference that would say that if you're applying the insurance model with unlocking for contractual cash flows, you would still recognize the deterioration directly in profit or loss.
So you're saying you're getting more service in the other scenarios?
You're getting the same service, it's just that the reinsurer's costs and profits are moving differently, but you're still getting the same service.
That's my point.
And so that would be the argument for unlocking for the contractual cash flows. But then something else is happening if the insurer's ability to pay you or to fulfill its contractual cash flows changes, and that's why you would recognise that immediately in profit or loss. So I did feel there was a difference there.
But I think what Martin raises makes, we need to articulate that a little bit better if we go with this suggestion.
Yeah.
I feel comfortable to do that because of the reasons I enunciated, but I think it's a fair question that needs an articulation.
Yep.
Then I don't think we are able to pinpoint and say, yep, that is the reason. I'm struggling with the explanation that I'm hearing, the 45, 46 paragraph that you raised. I don't think it gets there completely. But I think, honestly, I think it makes sense to do any updates of estimates through income statement. That's where I come from, so I agree with this. Like I said, it also, to some extent, purports with the original EED we did in impairment. So that's another reason I like it. But I don't think we got the full explanation.
Stephen?
Just moving away from the, just thinking about what Martin was saying, and moving away from the credit losses. There is no credit risk. Don't we still have a problem in the unlocking on the insurance and then the reinsurance contract? Because you unlock the insurance contract, and we've got this limit of the margin can't go negative. You unlock for the reinsurance, and the margin can go positive and negative. But doesn't that create a mismatch?
It does.
It does. But I think it comes back to the consideration of, for me, the contracts are separate. Yes, there is a link to the underlying that we talk about, but that gets dealt with how we estimate the building block one, which is cash flows. Then that gain or loss, if it's a loss, because we recalibrate a reinsurance asset to the premiums that we pay, we are saying that loss is then actually the cost that we're paying for reinsurance, and that is why we would still defer a loss for it. Where in, if we just think of an underlying insurance contract, that profit that we calibrate to a premium, similarly we say the residual margin, yes, it's an unearned profit, but it is a portion of the premiums that exceed the costs, and that gets recognized over time. So the gain that we're also deferring then for reinsurance assets on that aspect, we also said, well, we felt that gain only gets realized as we are delivering the underlying. So yes, there's a mismatch. The mismatch is not caused because the loss is being deferred. The mismatch is because there's a gain being not recognized on day one if we had mirroring. But the reason is that we also see that gain is only realizing as services are delivered. So for the arguments of gains and losses, for me, the situation is different for reinsurance than it was for the underlying and just a pure mirroring.
Yeah, I think, Steve, it's nothing to do with unlocking that you have the mismatch. It's to do with how you've treated the residual margin. And this is, in fact, one of the major concerns that's been raised to us on many occasions by a group of reinsurers, that they are uncomfortable with the fact that we take day one losses and spread day one gains for the underlying contract, but we spread those gains and losses on the reinsurance contract.
Are we ready to come to a conclusion?
Yes.
Thus, the question needs to be reformulated.
I think we should reformulate the question, and I think we should take it in two parts here. Do you want to go with the first part?
So for the question, just overall, what we want to ask is, should they account for the risk of non-performance associated with credit expected losses in the same way as other expected cash flows, but we're breaking that down in two. So for the first part, does the board agree on initial recognition that expected credit losses are taken into account in calibrating the residual margin?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes, first part.
Anyone disagrees? No?
So that's 14.
14. Pat is not on the phone anymore. Yep.
Then the second question is, does the board agree that subsequently the residual margin is unlocked for changes in credit losses? So this will be the proposal for staff to in the paper. Is there any?
One.
Very good. So,
and
whether some kind of cap notions will be used or.
We can bring that as a separate issue. We'll bring that as a sweep issue. We'll go.
And
so the conclusion of the board is that it needs to be taken directly to profit and loss.
And sorry, the rest gets taken into profits and loss subsequently changes. And then we don't have to do question two because that was only for if alternative two was selected.
Okay.
5 minutes break, we'll try and find the revenue team. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.